My name is Dan Lears. I'm the Newhall Curatorial Fellow in the Photography Department here at the Museum of Modern Art. Better?
Yes.
Okay. I'll also speak up. Before I begin, if I could just remind everyone to please silence your cell phones. Thank you. And I'm here today to speak to you about the exhibition Into the Sunset, Photography's Image of the American West, which is currently on view in the third floor galleries, or the special exhibition galleries, and will be on view from March 29th, it opened at the end of last month, running until June 8th. Has everyone had a chance to see the show? Has anyone had a chance to see the show? Good, good. So a lot of the images you'll be seeing here are familiar, but what I'll hopefully try to do is give you a little insight onto our thinking about the exhibition, how we developed the concept, and hopefully a little insight onto some of the individual photographs as well. And just as a sort of point of introduction, when we first started developing this idea of looking at the American West, we had several issues to grapple with. The first was, where do we draw the line geographically to begin dealing with this region? And we sort of set it as anywhere west of the Mississippi and in between the Canadian and Mexican borders. So certainly that definition is one that could be debated, and there are people who might define it differently. But we needed a finite region which we could really look at in order to have a manageable exhibition. And then the other thing that we were really thinking about was that we didn't want this to just be another sort of traditional landscape exhibition. We really wanted to look at the West in a new way, and primarily through the way that photography and the development of the region happened concurrently, and how both influenced each other in terms of how photography allowed people to explore the West, and also how photography adapted to the landscape of the West. So a lot of those issues were in the front of our minds as we were thinking about the exhibition, and one of the main reasons we also started doing this exhibition was the strength of the museum's collection in that particular area. About 60% of the photographs in the show come from the museum's collection, 40% are borrowed from other institutions, and I think it's really a testament to the fact that the West has been able to hold our attention for such a long time that an East Coast institution such as MoMA does have such a wide variety of images depicting the area. So, to begin with, I'll sort of start looking at the landscape of the West. And like I said, we didn't want it to be a traditional show of photographs such as this by Ansel Adams, although certainly you have to include these photographs in the show. Ansel Adams was absolutely key in developing our understanding of this pristine landscape. And his proficiency in printing, as you can see, every single detail of his prints are just absolutely perfect, are certainly an important characteristic of photographing in the West. And I should note that he was not working with your traditional handheld camera, and this is one of those things that I was talking about, the technological developments of the American West, of photography with the American West. He's using a large format 8x10-inch camera and on a tripod, and going, and the camera is not very mobile. It has to be stationary. It requires long exposure times. And so all of these sort of things, though, lend themselves to those expansive landscapes that we maybe associate with so much of the West. And likewise, Minor White in his photograph of the Grand Tetons in Wyoming. And, you know, it's, again, these sort of, here you have this almost heavenly light shining down on the mountainscapes, and it's this idea that the landscape is absolutely pristine and untouched. There's never any sign of people or development. And for a long time, this was the way that we perceived the West. And it wasn't simply these later photographers who established this. This is a tradition that goes a ways back, even as early as turn of the century. And this photograph by Alvin Langdon Coburn, looking at the cloudscapes of the West. He was very interested in the atmosphere of the area. And we have photographs in this exhibition which date as early as 1850, with some of the early daguerreotypes, which I'll be showing shortly. And then the show does continue all the way up until the present day. So another indication that, the subject has held interest for a significant amount of time in our history. And honestly, these photographs, a great deal of them, went a long way to preserving some of the landscape that we now know in the West. For example, Muybridge's view of Valley of the Yosemite. It was when Lincoln saw many of these photographs of these untouched landscapes, he decided that it was important that we make these into national parks, and they did indeed become the park system that we know today. So, in a good sense, photography did bring about our understanding of the early landscape, and it also served to preserve some of the landscape that we still see today. But what it also did was gave this idea of bountiful resources, and this idea that the West was a land of promise. And so very quickly there was this idea of, well, if there is so much resource out there, and if there is so much bounty out there, then perhaps it is our manifest destiny to go and explore it. And so that's even hinted at in this photograph, a very iconic image by Ansel Adams of the moonrise over Hernandez, New Mexico. And you start to see now small cities and villages beginning to crop up on this landscape. And so that brings us to this category of the people, the settlers, who began to move to the West and colonize it. So here you have this early Mormon family in the Great Salt Lake Valley. Again, a very early photograph from the late 1860s. The homesteaders who were going out and claiming the land, which the government was offering basically free of charge. You just had to get out there and stake your claim, and you could simply own a certain amount of land. And so it was this idea that everybody wanted to get their piece of the pie. And then certainly people such as the gold miners who were going out there in the Great Gold Rush, and, you know, really defining themselves by why they went out there. I mean, this gentleman here has clearly wanted to show the fact that he was a miner. He didn't go into the photography studio and sit down for a portrait in his everyday clothes. He went there and sat down with the tools of his trade. And that was really a defining characteristic for him. Likewise, many of the there were many immigrants coming to the area, Asians and Eastern Europeans as well. And they certainly went into developing the communities in many of the cities in the West. Here is Street of the Gamblers by Arnold Genth, a view of Chinatown in San Francisco. And also, of course, the native people who were already on the land oftentimes. And here a portrait of a Native American by Gertrude Casebeer. And interestingly enough, and this is where we get into this idea of the myth of the West and how photography doesn't always necessarily present a truth of the West. This photograph was taken on the East Coast in the Boston studio of Gertrude Casebeer, and the Native American is actually a member of Buffalo Bill's Wild West troupe. As you may know, Buffalo Bill was hiring Native Americans as well as people from the Middle East and asking them to wear their native garb in reenacting various battles and scenes from American history. And these were costumes. I mean, these were not necessarily things that this gentleman was wearing every day. So Casebeer here has asked this gentleman to dress up in his costume, and she's even gone so far as posing him in a way that emphasizes that costume. So you see that he's turned into the profile, and really the feathers and the headdress are heavily accentuated in such a photograph. And likewise, in this portrait by John Hillers of the Moki Girls, these are young women actually preparing for marriage. And you can see that Hillers has placed blankets and various tapestries both behind and beneath these girls. And this wasn't something that was a natural scene. If you can sort of make out actually behind the blankets here, you know, they're set up against some sort of adobe structure. The blankets were set up as to give the illusion that this was a sort of tapestry that was covering much of the settlement and that this was the robes worn by these people. And it's not necessarily the truth. It's one depiction of how things looked back then. And then, you know, people themselves, as I mentioned also with that gold miner, were interested in creating their own myths as well. And so here you have this gentleman from the early 1850s who's dressed up as a cowboy and shown himself with all of the various trappings that come with being a cowboy, including the ever-important saddle. And cowboys obviously are a major picture of what we might imagine when we look at think of the West. And so there's a whole subsection in the exhibition, which some of you might have seen, that deals with cowboys and the way that cowboys, even within the type of person of a cowboy, there are numerous depictions in photography of cowboys. And so you have the sort of very flat advertised image, I believe, of Hank Williams in his cowboy hat in the storefront window in California. And then similarly, John Baldessari's photograph. This is one of my favorite photographs in the exhibition, on loan from the Broad Foundation in Santa Monica. And this is really looking at how cowboys were depicted on the silver screen. And once again, that's just sort of one cross-section of maybe how we think of cowboys. But you have the great westerns of John Ford. And, of course, those kinds of pictures form how we think of this region. And so Baldessari looks at that depiction. And then somebody like Cindy Sherman, with her Untitled Film Still series. Again, she's gone into this Monument Valley landscape made famous by John Ford. But rather than giving us that traditional cowboy that maybe we would have seen in the first picture of the gentleman with his saddle, now she's a cowgirl, and she's dressed up. Interestingly enough, she took this photograph while on vacation with her family. They were on a cross-country road trip, and she saw the landscape and simply got out and put on this costume and played another role and created another sort of myth. And James Leventhal does a similar thing with this photograph, what appears to be maybe a sort of traditional sunset image of the cowboy with his horse, is actually a tableau that he's created with little toy soldiers or little toy dolls, and photographed them from very close up. And again, it's sort of tweaking your perception and maybe making you look twice and think again about, you know, how exactly have these images been presented to us throughout history. And then one of the last photographs from this section that we'll look at is Richard Prince's Untitled Cowboy. And this photograph introduces the show. It's the first image that you see when you enter. And in part because it touches on so many of the different themes in the show. But they're not always readily apparent. And first, it probably helps to know that what Prince has done here is re-photographed an advertising image that was used by Marlboro to advertise cigarettes. So this is a Marlboro man taken from a magazine, which he has subsequently re-photographed and blown up to a very large size. And all of a sudden, that sort of romanticized shot of the cowboy jumping in his lasso with the endless horizon in the background has a little bit more of a sinister take, maybe, when we realize that, wait a second, this was used by a tobacco company to, you know, maybe aggrandize that very rogue lifestyle. And then it also helps to know that right around the time that these photographs, these advertising images were coming about, several of the Marlboro men, there wasn't just one, but the gentleman who posed for these photographs as Marlboro men passed away from lung cancer. So, there's always, in a lot of these photographs, there's a sort of behind-the-scenes story going on, and that's one of the things that we really hope, by showing them all together, you begin to realize and create maybe different pictures of the West and think about things slightly differently. And so after thinking about the various people who went out and settled the West, then we begin to think about, well, how did they get out there? And, of course, transportation was a key factor in the colonization and the development of the West, and railroads being perhaps primarily the main first form of transportation. And, you know, railroads were really a symbol of human dominance of the landscape. And, you know, you can see here from Andrew Russell's view of Granite Canyon, you know, mountains were simply leveled or large levees were built to create space for these tracks. And some of you might be familiar with that famous image of the driving of the Golden Spike in Promontory, Utah, where the two rail lines met. I mean, oftentimes these were huge feats of strength and endurance, and really they were representative of man's dominance over the landscape. And so now we begin to see that initial idea of preservation of the pristine landscape that we saw earlier in the presentation has now transformed slightly into, well, it manifests destiny, this idea that landscape was there for us to possess and there for us to use and harness to our own good. And so then quickly we go from railroads to highways and roads. And again, this very iconic image by Dorothea Lange of the highway going on for forever, with no cars on it, of course, and no people or endpoint visible. But that's, you know, very evocative of this idea that you can just sort of get on the road and drive without a destination in mind and without anybody around to bother you. And a lot of photographers really latched onto this in the 50s and onward. And that idea of the road trip became very significant in photographic practice. And many people, including Lee Friedlander, began jumping in a car with their camera equipment. And now also notice that we've moved into the handheld 35mm format, so that you can actually snap a picture right out the window with your side view mirror in view and the landscape behind. So it's this idea that all of a sudden we are now mobile in this landscape and we can move about it freely as we wish. And not only that, we can also begin to populate it with things that look familiar to us. So then you begin to see signage and gas stations, and so much of the signage from this time is just fantastic. The Save Gas from Robert Frank's Santa Fe, New Mexico shot of the 50s, and then a couple of my favorites here, Edward Weston, Quaker State Oil, Arizona. Again, there's no cars on the road. The road doesn't seem to have a beginning or an end point. Who knows who the sign was intended for? Because if you need oil on this point of the road, I think you're going to be in trouble, judging from this photograph. So there's a certain amount of, looming, possibly there's some bad things on the horizon. And likewise, his photograph of hot coffee in the Mojave Desert, you know, I can only imagine who in 110 degree weather is dying for a cup of hot coffee, but somehow these signs pop up along the landscape. And they begin to form sort of markers and things for us to latch onto and things for us to identify with. But there's always that sort of whimsy that's going on with them too. And then Stephen Shore, who really epitomized that road trip, did a large road trip in the mid-70s, going all the way from New York to California. And here are photographs Beverly Boulevard in California. And what I really love about this photograph is the way that the signage and even the patterns of the elements in the photograph. So, for example, you have the chevron pointing down to the chevron and then continuing along into the Texaco and the no stamps signs here, but how that's paralleled with the light posts and telephone poles and even the white lines of the highway. And they all sort of draw your eye down along this horizon. And again, with this idea of no endpoint, all of a sudden now we have this idea of suburban sprawl. And of course, Los Angeles is one of those cities notorious for being low to the ground and endless, and one in which you sort of need a car to get around. And so then again, so now this idea of suburbia and development begins to come into play. And so we have photographs like this selection from Ed Ruscha's parking lots, where, well, with all those cars that we're now driving out to the west, we need a place to put them. And so he's looked at those interstitial spaces where all of a sudden we need to put the transportation which we use to get out there and to park it, and these sort of empty spaces in the midst of much larger spaces. And, you know, likewise, Dorothea Lange's view of housing development in Milpitas. I mean, it looks like somebody has just dropped these houses down from outer space in front of this mountain range. I can't imagine anybody wanting to live there in the state that it's in now, but there was this idea that, and it's really embodied in this series of photographs, that when you went out to the west, you could get your own piece of the pie. You could get your space, and you could be surrounded by this incredible landscape. And in fact, this group of photographs was used by the Lakewood, California, which is still one of the largest suburban developments there. It was used for advertising purposes to sell these homes. And so you have, it runs in a very chronological order. You can see the land was raised and leveled, and then plots were measured out. The foundations were laid, framing was done, roofing was done, and then all of a sudden you have this sort of body snatchers type Lakewood, California development where every house looks identical, everyone has the same size lot, and really there's no variation whatsoever. And yet this was clearly an American ideal. The fact that this company was using these photographs to sell these houses meant that there were people who were looking for this type of lifestyle. And this idea that you could go out there and you know, like I said, have a piece of the pie. And I think that's really another important characteristic of the West. But, of course, with that then also comes a certain sense of isolation, perhaps. And so you'll see a lot of photographs here where you have developments, but then you have very few people or no people. And in this case, you have this child with his toy on this house that's sort of dwarfed by these mountains. And it's, again, a very sort of ominous and foreboding photograph. And similarly, this photograph by Robert Adams from Colorado Springs, he was taking pictures of a lot of the ranch houses and developments that were in Colorado and the Plains States there. And, you know, the isolation of this character, of this figure in the windows, I think really speaks to the sense that, yeah, you could go out there and get your piece of the American pie, but it wouldn't necessarily be the friendliest place, and there certainly aren't a lot of other people out there. And likewise, Joel Sternfeld's view of Lake Oswego, Oregon, you have this, you know, nice houses and a nice little cul-de-sac with a basketball hoop and a car, but there's no people, and you have these, again, storm clouds seeming to brew over the houses, and you just wonder, well, what's going on? Where is everybody? And it's interesting, and you know, this is another example of how photography is painting a very specific picture of the West. I've been to Lake Oswego and in this particular housing development, and it's a perfectly nice housing development, and families are very happy there, and you know, it's a wonderful community. But Sternfeld certainly didn't want to depict it that way. He chose this view for a very specific reason, and he's trying to portray a very specific type of view of the American West. And that's what I'm talking about when I talk about these concurrent myths that are being created with photography and the landscape. And, you know, indeed, some people actually go out to the West to be isolated. And John Davola did this series called Isolated Houses, and he simply gives the geographical coordinates of these houses. But these are people who are literally living off the grid. They moved out to this area and wanted to be left alone. You can see the power line coming in from the left to this house, and that's it. There's nothing else connecting this house to the outside world. And honestly, that's how the person wanted it. So, you know, you have a very interesting look at the ways that the landscape became to be developed. And then you also have the kinds of people who were inhabiting these areas. And so similar to that Lake Oswego view, now you have actually some people who are living in these developments. And here in Canyon Country, California, a father and daughter. And I love this photograph. This is from a series that Bill Owens did called Suburbia. And he's paired the images with quotes from the sitters in the photograph. And in this case, we are really happy, our kids are healthy, we eat good food, and we have a really nice home. Well, I mean, that's all well and good until you sort of see that wait a second, you know, maybe things aren't as nice as they appear when you notice that there are these huge power lines right outside their house, and all of a sudden, you know, there's a whole other element to the photograph. And Owens was certainly aware of that. And all of a sudden, this sort of idyllic home scene takes on another meaning. And likewise, Joel Meyerowitz's view from Los Angeles of this couple, and they seem to be in some sort of Edenic paradise, and then you realize that the palm trees and the waterfall scene are painted onto the cement wall of the building behind them, and the grass that they're sitting on is actually astroturf because they couldn't keep grass growing in the climate. So, you know, everything is not necessarily as it appears. And other groups certainly went out there as well. William Gedney is documenting a lot of the hippies and sort of flower children who were living out in San Francisco in the late 60s. And again, this is a very real depiction, I think. I think that this is a sense that, you know, the hippies went out there to find true love and to be free, and they were very happy like that, and Gedney shows them as such. And likewise, Todd Papajor's view of Hermosa Beach, California, and the sort of beach bums who were just lounging around the beach but being themselves and enjoying their life of being on the beach and not seeming to have any cares and not having any worries. And likewise, Gary Winogrand's view of Los Angeles, you know, people dressed in costumes and, you know, wearing roller skates and just sort of being free. But all of them, to a certain extent, are also types. And this is a great example of that. Joel Sternfeld's view of a woman at home after exercising, you know, anybody could create a sort of story in their head about this woman. She's wearing her fancy Pucci exercise outfit and eating her her healthy light lunch in this incredible view over the beach in Malibu. But it's one of those things where, you know, you, when looking at it, you maybe start to create a story about who this woman is and what she does and why she's out there. And I think that's one of the important things in these photographs as well, is that we begin to create our own stories too, and we begin to bring our own associations of the landscape to these photographs as well. And then another, you know, aspect of things, obviously, is the movie star and the whole idea of Hollywood. And so you have the sort of glitz and glamour of Hollywood. But I think more often than not, the perception is that that sort of glitz and glamour is very flat and superficial. And Lee Friedlander obviously gets at that here with this photograph of a couple that had been cut out and pasted on a window with the palm trees in the reflection, that things can be sort of artificial, even though they might seem so glamorous and great. So then we begin maybe to look at the darker side of things and the not-so-happy people and the maybe margins of society, you might say. And, you know, beginning with a photograph by Joel Sternfeld of a member of a religious sect. And, you know, this idea that lots of communities of people go out there specifically to be left alone and to be left on the sort of outskirts and not have to conform to anything. And likewise, you know, this is maybe the other side of the Hollywood scene. Larry Sultan did a series called The Valley, where he was actually photographing pornographic film shootings. And so what seems to be, oh, a sort of, you know, couple at home or something, you realize very quickly that there's a shot going on here in the background from a porn film. So, you know, it's a very vibrant industry out in California, as I understand it, and it's also one side of the whole film world that's going on out there. And but it's not necessarily something that we might think of when we think of the traditional Hollywood scene in California. And then, you know, similarly, this very iconic image of Dorothea Lange, of this woman who was in California living on the Dust Bowl and just trying to make it with her children in the time of the Depression. And interestingly enough, though this woman, you know, today seems so down and out and so sort of put out by the economic conditions of the time, the government actually used this image in FDR's New Deal to promote help for these people. And so This Dorothy Lang took this photograph as part of the FSA, the Farm Security Administration, where they were really trying to get people to either stay out on their farms in the West or move out there and get subsidies from the government. And so, in a sense, this image actually began to take on a sort of romanticized view of, yes, this woman is down and out on her luck with her two children, but she's surviving, and she's surviving in the most difficult of conditions. So, again, while the photograph itself hasn't changed, the way that it's been interpreted and utilized throughout the course of history has, and that inflects how we begin to see the landscape and the people that live there. And then another example of somebody who, you know, might seem a little down and out, but still has this aura of glamour about her is Philip Lorca de Corsia's series of hustlers that he's photographed, in this case in Nevada. The title is always the name of the person, their age, the city where he shot them, and then a dollar amount. And the dollar amount is actually how much that hustler would charge for sexual favors on the street. But in this case, he's paid them and just asked them to sit for a photograph. And so, again, it's this idea that, you know, perhaps Marilyn has gone out there to make it big in the movie scene and just didn't make it for whatever reason, and now all of a sudden she's out on the streets. But there's still this sort of sense of glamour, like I said, and it's an interesting dualism, I think, going on in these kinds of photographs. And likewise, William Gedney's view of, there's nothing embodies the idea of a broken dream more than this: a guy with his head in his hands sleeping on the floor of some apartment, and you have the sort of trifecta with James Dean in the background, the Trinity with James Dean in the background. You know, clearly, Marlon Brando. I'm sorry, you know, this idea that, you know, Marlon Brando was just absolutely iconic, and so many people would have aspired to have been like him, and yet this guy clearly just didn't make it. And likewise, Katie Grannon's view of Nicole. And it's interesting because when I saw this image, I had a similar view as maybe I would have thought about that photograph of Marilyn, this woman who clearly there's a sense of glamour, but she's just sort of down and out of luck. And interestingly enough, Katie Grannon was here at the museum for a panel a couple weeks ago, and she said that one of the reasons that she actually began photographing Nicole was that she had this incredible energy and this real vivacity. And so when I heard that, I thought, oh, wait a second, maybe I'm looking at the picture differently. And I went back to it, and I still see an energy, but I don't see a real exuberance that Katie was talking about. And I think that that's another sort of interesting idea of what's going on in the show, is that, you know, while we might bring our own stories to the photograph, what the photographer is thinking and what actually might be going on can be totally different. I think that still plays into this idea that we create our own myths and legends of the West, and the way that those things get distributed can vary, and that certainly happens in photographs. And, you know, I can keep my story about how I think Nicole came to be as she is here. And Katie has a totally different story, and she asked Nicole actually to not dress up and put on makeup for this picture, and Nicole said, oh yeah, sure, she agreed. And then as soon as she came out of her car to pose, she was wearing this totally dramatic top, you know, midriff top, and it's hard to make out, but she's worn makeup and even drawn mascara down her neck in this really almost clownish sort of overdone way. So it was this idea that, you know, you can try to have me be a certain way that you want me to be, but I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to sort of be the way that I want to be. And I think for a lot of people, that's one of the reasons why you might move to the West. And likewise, Richard Avedon's, this is from his very famous series, American West. And I love this picture. Again, you know, perhaps the title, The Unemployed Blackjack Dealer, gives us a little too much information because it's sort of puts him into a pigeonhole, but I think that there's a great deal of dignity and, and a certain majesty to this picture. And you know, obviously, if he's unemployed and out of work in Reno, Nevada, he can't be doing that well. And yet, to me, he just sort of has this timeless, weathered look that he's going to endure no matter what. And I love that photograph for this. And so we sort of end with this section, and I mean, I realize that the exhibition does this, and it certainly wasn't intentional, and I think partly it's a reflection of the way that photographers have been photographing the West recently, but on a sort of down note, and this idea that our effects on the land have changed it irrevocably and damaged it for a great deal of future generations. And so, you know, Darius Kinsey's view of this logging camp, at the time, maybe it was seen as, wow, you know, look at how much timber was coming out of there, and look at all this amazing resource for lumber that we have. But now when we see it, it's unbelievable that, you know, these areas were just being clear-cut and burned with absolutely no thought about what the consequences might be. Similarly, David Hance's view of this mining runoff in Leadville, Colorado. And, you know, it's interesting that the exact stuff that we would absolutely not want in the landscape, and all of the runoff that not even the miners want. I mean, this is something that nobody can use, but it has to go somewhere. And meanwhile, it goes on to create a very beautiful picture. So this idea that something so ugly and terrible can be so beautiful is really an interesting duality, I think. This image, you might be familiar with it. It's the cover of the catalog for the exhibition. You have, you know, the three elements that I think really are touched on in the show, and you have the ideal landscape with the mountainscape in the background, and then you also have the low suburban development here, and then you have the landslide in the foreground, and this idea that everything is just sort of falling down and the car is tumbling into the ravine. It's certainly a sort of a dire picture of the consequences of this development, you know, people are obviously affected as well. And here, Karen Mueller's picture from Angel in the Fall, this is a view of Los Angeles, and it's hard to make out, but amidst all of these tall buildings and, you know, fast-moving cars, there's a lone figure here who's sort of sorting through all of the refuse and cast-offs of this society and trying to make the best of all of the trash and excess that is produced by this society. Similarly, Jeffrey James's view, this is from a series called Running Fence, and it's difficult to make out what's going on, but essentially this is the border fence that's been created between Mexico and California, and the California side is in the foreground, so there's no development on the American side of the fence, and then you can see on the Mexican side they've built all the way up until the very edge of the fence. And this idea that, you know, while other countries are having to fit as many people as possible in this land, you know, we are trying to get as far away from it as possible and really try to turn our backs to it. And Jeffrey James has tried to call attention to the fact of how this man-made implement on the landscape has absolutely scarred it and changed it. And similarly, on Millet's view of army training that goes on in the deserts, they use it because the landscape is so similar to the Middle East, and they just sort of drop bombs and set off mortars without any thought of, you know, well, there's nobody there now, so why would anybody want to be there in the future? It's you know, it's a difficult point because it's obviously something that, you know, the troops need, something that emulates the experience of going to battle in the conditions in which they're going to be in the future. But at the same time, you know, where can they do that where it won't affect somebody? And I think Amile has really addressed that problem very beautifully. And I'll end with this photograph by Stephen Shore. Again, one of my favorite photographs in the show. And all of a sudden now, photography has essentially substituted for our imagination of the West. And so here in this picture, Stephen Shore doesn't even let us conjure up the mountainscape that we might think of when we think of the American West and the sort of endless mountainscapes. he just gives it to us, and he gives it to us in the form of some billboard that the logo has even been painted over, but some billboard that some advertising executive obviously created. And you know, this is supposed to touch on all of our ideals and imagination about the West, and in a sense, it sort of does. It fits perfectly into the landscape. But we have to always remember that it's only one side of the story. It's obviously a very flat picture, and certainly things are not necessarily as they always appear. So I'll leave you with that image, but I am happy to take questions or comments. Yes?
How does Richard Prince get away with photographing somebody else's work of art, basically Xeroxing it, blowing it up to whatever number he's dialing it up to, and call it a brand new?
Right, right. The question is, how does Richard Prince get away with the re-photography that he's doing, with taking copyrighted materials and blowing them up, Xeroxing them, whatever, re-photographing them? He makes the argument, and has actually been vindicated as such, that he is altering the materials enough and presenting them in a new context to the point where they are unique individual artworks, and therefore totally devoid of any of the original copyright being held. He always cuts out the logos, so that's a very important thing. You'll never see a Marlboro sign. You could certainly be sued. So he's very conscious of that. But he also makes the argument that I'm repurposing it to the point where it has become an absolute unique artwork, and it is no longer the advertisement for which it was originally created. Yes.
I have a question about the evolution of photography as we're going to a digital photography where we can play with images so much. I would like your opinion on like compare and contrast a photograph with a painting in today's world.
Well, you know, in terms of this show at least, very early on, paintings, you know, very large-scale landscape paintings by somebody like Albert Bierstadt, were the equivalent to photographs. And there were subscription services where people could buy a painting a month, essentially, that he was painting in the West. And people in Boston and New York could do that, and they could see the landscape that was out there past the Mississippi. And when photography came about, they started doing the same thing. People like Carlton Watkins were going out and taking these large plate pictures, which were being mailed back to people on the East Coast. And all of a sudden, photography sort of supplanted painting in depicting these landscapes. And, you know, I don't think that the digital photography that's happening today will supplant the film photography that was happening earlier. I think that there are enough people who have reacted against that idea of the digital photograph being something that you can just snap and throw away if you don't like it, and have held on to this. Sometimes, I mean, there are people, Stephen Shore, for example, who are still using the large format cameras today. And so there's still a certain sense of tradition and a certain group of people who want to hold on to this idea of the film and this objecthood of the photograph. Yes?
That was my question about tradition. Did Hans Latimus or any of the early ones give workshops? Or was there any kind of cross-pollination with sharing ideas, photography leads?
Yes, absolutely. Ansel Adams was a member of a photography lead. He was actually a member, very briefly, of Magnum, which was a large photojournalism agency that was sending photographers all around the world, and he was their sort of West Coast correspondent. And there was a lot of cross-pollination, and I think one of the only reasons that we have as many depictions of the West as we do, but so many people playing into those depictions, is that people were talking, people were seeing different images, advertising was affecting things. You know, people were seeing the Marlboro ad, and then they were seeing the Richard Prince photograph and thinking, wait a second, I've seen that somewhere else, and realizing, oh, okay, that came from a totally different context. So there is a certain amount of dialogue going on between the photographers, certainly. Yes?
Two questions. Well, Ansel Adams' photographs were highly manipulated. I mean, I saw working prints of his, and they're just dodged and, I mean, completely manipulated. It's not taken and not printed. And the other thing I want, why are some of the pictures upstairs covered?
Yeah, the reason that we have to cover the pictures is that there are certain light level issues that we have to deal with, and these are not photographs from our collection. When we've borrowed photographs from other institutions, they sometimes put stipulations that the photographs can only receive a certain amount of light during the week, and so they ask that we cover it during certain points. And it's not our ideal situation, but because they're... Yes, certainly. And then in regards to this idea of manipulation, absolutely. You know, Adams was dodging and burning and retouching and all of those things. But I think that plays into this idea that he didn't want to present a sort of muddy landscape, or, you know, he wanted to get rid of anything that didn't comply with his perfect idealized vision of how that land should look. So, yes.
How many photos does MoMA have in their collection of these in American West? And who has the largest collection of these in the U.S.? I see a lot of, I can see the shot, I see a lot of spaghetti, but who has the largest collection?
I couldn't tell you exact numbers of West-related materials in the museum's collection, but the Amon Carter is a museum in Fort Worth, Texas, which... has a huge Western photography collection, and some of the works are borrowed from them, and the Getty is also very well represented. Well, if there's nothing else, thanks very much for coming, and I urge you to go and check out the exhibition.